Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
The United States has made it clear no U.S. troops will fight Russia in Ukraine. And even today, as President Biden bans U.S. imports of Russian energy, the American government is doing a lot behind the scenes. Leading up to Russia's invasion, the president took the rare step of disclosing intelligence with sensitive details about Vladimir Putin's war plans. Let's talk more about that intelligence with Stanford professor Amy Ziegert. She's an expert on spycraft and author of a new book called Spies, Lies, and Algorithms: The History and Future of American Intelligence. Amy, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure. So based on your deep experience here, how active do you think U.S. intelligence agencies are right now in Ukraine and Russia?
Oh, they're very active. I think they're working overtime in Ukraine and Russia. And we can see this by the near constant rate of disclosures, really unprecedented dissemination about Putin's plans, about his troop movements, in near real time, often about what he's up to and what's happening on the ground.
How good was that intelligence?
I think it was remarkably good. You might recall a few days ago, which feels like years, President Zelensky was questioning the intelligence, saying that we were hyping the threat and roiling his economy. And yet the intelligence kept coming and the confidence seemed very high. And now, of course, it turns out that that intelligence by the U.S. and our allied nations was accurate.
One of the most remarkable things is that we even had that intelligence in the first place. And when I say we, I mean you and I, members of the public. How unheard of was that in the history of U.S. intelligence agencies?
It's never happened before. It is a remarkable change in practice. You know, intelligence agencies never like to reveal information to the public because doing so risks their sources and methods. If they reveal intelligence, they might never get that intelligence from those sources again. This was a big, big deal.
So one of the questions is why? And I gather from some of your writing that one of the goals was to get ahead of Russia, this country that is a master at spreading disinformation. Do you think it helped getting ahead of the narrative?
I think it helped a lot. You know, as the intelligence was being released, I kept asking myself, what are the goals of this release? And I really think there are three purposes. The first is inoculation against information warfare. You know, the Russians are pros when it comes to deception. We saw this in Crimea the last time Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014. We saw it with the 2016 presidential election. And what I think the Biden administration strategy did was it got the truth out before the lie. And so it made it much harder for the world to believe Putin's false narratives about a phony pretext for invasion when the intelligence kept coming out. So I think the first goal is inoculation. But the second goal was friction, making Putin question, how do the Americans and the British know what's going on? Where are my weaknesses in my own intelligence operations? You know, he's a former KGB guy. And so the more he had to spend his efforts on thinking about his own lapses, the less he could spend time on defense. So it knocked him off his game, and that's helpful in the long run. And then the last reason, I think, has to do with removing the fig leaf excuse. You know, it's a lot harder for countries to sit on the sidelines and or help Russia on the sly when everything is in the open. And so I think it's one of the reasons we see the Swiss, for example, the Swiss of all people, right, weighing in and not staying neutral and joining sanctions. I think it has a contributing role to play in why Germany went from being wobbly on Nord Stream 2 and other areas of the conflict to really being fully behind the Allied position. So that, you know, removing the opportunity for third-party countries to sit this one out was a useful goal.
So it may have done all of those things. It may have knocked Putin off of his game, but it didn't stop Putin from attacking Ukraine. And it wasn't risk-free, was it? I mean, what do you think the U.S. intelligence agencies may have given up with this strategy?
Well, I think it's unrealistic to expect that just disclosing intelligence about Putin's intentions will stop him from invading. So I don't think that was ever really the definition of success. But of course, as you point out, there are risks to this strategy. The first we talked about, that you can lose your intelligence sources, whether they're human sources or technical sources. But the second is that you can make crises harder to manage. So when you reveal everything that an adversary is doing, it can be humiliating and box them into a corner. And that may feel good in the moment, but you need to find face-saving exits in a crisis, and publicizing the intelligence makes that job harder.
I'm thinking one of the dangers of boxing a man like Vladimir Putin into a corner is that he's unpredictable and he has nuclear weapons.
Absolutely. But, you know, he's unpredictable without boxing him into a corner. We look at the past several years and we tried not to box him into a corner, and look where that got us. It got us into increasing aggression on his part. So I think the other strategies have failed. And this one at least makes it possible to box him into a corner and then propose an exit ramp to get to some kind of settlement down the line.
Another thing that I'm noticing is that it's not just governments gathering intelligence in this conflict. A lot of what we know about the war, it comes from satellite images, from commercial companies, from open sources on the internet. And we also live in a digital age when, you know, journalists like me, we're speaking to people in a war zone on smartphones. What do you think this conflict tells us about the future of intelligence gathering?
I think this conflict is the poster child of the revolution in open source intelligence. And I talk a lot about this in my book, and how ordinary people and organizations are actually able to collect intelligence, analyze intelligence, and disseminate intelligence, even on the most secretive of threats, which is, you know, nuclear activities where proliferators are trying to hide them. And we're seeing this play out in real time in Ukraine. You know, satellite imagery on the front pages of the New York Times, people on the ground. And so they're all sources of intelligence now. And it's spying and intelligence aren't just for governments anymore. It's a radical transformation of the intelligence business.
Do you see that as a net gain or a risk?
It's both. So the plus side, right, is that there are more people and there's more information out there, and it can be shared because it's not classified. But there are real risks to this world also. You know, the big risk, of course, the one that's most obvious, is that errors can go viral because there's no quality control. There's no vetting. And we're seeing this in Ukraine as well, with disinformation just flooding the open source world. So that's sort of one downside. The second downside is that, again, crises can become harder to manage because now you have forced transparency and speed with this open source intelligence. And that can really remove the room to maneuver for both sides or multiple sides in a conflict. So transparency and speed are not always a good thing when it comes to intelligence.
For many people watching this war, there may be a shade of deja vu at play here. The modern CIA, born in 1947 after World War II, blossomed in the Cold War era, an effort, of course, to defeat the Soviets. What lessons do you think the United States learned from that time that might help its intelligence gathering in this conflict?
Well, I think we've seen repeatedly throughout history that it takes a crisis to reform our intelligence agencies. That was true with Pearl Harbor and the CIA's creation in the 40s. It was true with 9/11. And the creation of the Director of National Intelligence, the National Counterterrorism Center, and a host of other capabilities after that tragic terrorist attack. And now we're having a transformational moment again. And I think what it suggests is we have to radically reform our intelligence community to be able to harness emerging technologies, understand them, and use them better. And you know, technology number one is the basket of tools that are in this open source world. It's not enough just to focus on secret agencies. We need a dedicated new open source intelligence agency to focus our efforts on that part of the intelligence enterprise.
And when it comes to technology, I'm thinking the Russians, again, are masters at cyber warfare. Do you think the United States is equipped to outspy the Russians on that front?
You know, I think so, although cyber warfare is very highly classified. You know, one of the big questions that experts keep asking is, why haven't we seen more cyber warfare? Why haven't the Russians unleashed more in Ukraine? Why haven't they unleashed more in the world? It's a question I think a lot of analysts are thinking about, because many people assume that that would be the tool of choice at the start of this invasion, and that's not turned out to be true. But we do know that U.S. cyber capabilities really have made a shift in the past several years to a strategy called defending forward, or persistent engagement. And that means taking the fight to the adversary, getting into their systems before they attack us. And I think it's a smart strategy.
Amy Ziegert is author of the new book, Spies, Lies, and Algorithms, The History and Future of American intelligence, talking to us through the lens of the conflict in Ukraine. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you.